The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning to you. 3 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 5th of January, 2024. And you're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. And we have our Friday panel who will introduce to you very shortly. We want you involved in the conversation as well. And I'll give you a quick reminder of the numbers. If you want to WhatsApp or text us, it's 086 60 25,000. From outside the Republic, that's 00353 86 60 25,000. And if you want to give us a call, it's 074 91 25,000. You can email comments at highlandradio.com. Just to remind you, if you want to watch today's show on your smart TV or Fire Stick, you can go to YouTube, both preloaded for the most part, and type in Highland Radio Ireland. And you can take us on your mobile devices with YouTube and Facebook as well, Highland Hub, Highland Radio News and Sports. So with all that done, let's say good morning to our guests. And it is good morning and a happy new year to Cathy Donaghy, journalist and author of Finding My Wild. Good morning to you, Cathy. How are you getting on?
Great, Greg. Yeah, right, happy new year to you. Lovely to be back.
You're a sea swimmer, aren't you? So you would have welcomed all of those that don't do it at any other time of the year, out dipping for, you know, St. Stephen's Day or New Year's Day or what have you. Was it overcrowded for your usual activities?
Yeah, there were a lot of spectators actually this year, as many spectators as swimmers. But you know, it's lovely because I think anything that brings people out and brings them to the sea and maybe try and dip in their toe for the first time. Although I do think that if you're thinking about sea swimming or taking it up as a hobby or a pastime, it's probably the worst time of the year to get started. You know, you'd be better maybe going gently in around August, September, when the water is nice and warm. It's getting colder now, and it's only going to get colder now till March, Greg. So yeah, there's a real bite in it at this time, but always wonderful. But I do think caution, I would urge a wee bit of caution just about starting right now. You know, it is
normally go in the sea once a year, and it's normally towards the end of the summer. I like to do it once a year to say I had done it. I don't know if I'll ever become a cold water sea swimmer, but John McAteer, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune newspaper, a very good morning to you, John. How are you keeping?
I'm fine, Greg, thank you very much.
And a very happy new year to you as well.
And to you.
And it's great to have Mary Hart, who is a journalist and broadcaster, back on the show. Hi, Mary.
Good morning, Greg. And just to add, I too am a sea swimmer.
Are you, Mary? Okay.
Yes,
all year round.
Last year in Rathmullen, and a great bunch of ladies. And a big shout out to them if any of them are listening this morning. But yeah, I agree with Cathy. If you're not a regular sea swimmer, it's horrendously cold.
but you do get used to it, Mary, do you?
You do. And I'm telling you, it is one of the best things. I'm not a great swimmer at all, but just even being in the water for, you know, even 10 minutes. And, you know, I did try to take lessons down with the Tonta Swim down in Port Nibla and Marble Hill. And that was a great experience too.
Okay, so
yeah,
I think
it's great. It's really, really, really good.
Unless John is about to shock me out of my seat, me and him are the outliers here then. So, John, you a sea swimmer?
No, I used to.
Right.
I used to swim until about the end of November.
Okay, and then
I gave that up for better pursuits like walking the dog.
Yes, okay. Just listened to the news from Donal there, and it kind of almost leads into something else we were going to talk about. Restaurants are being urged to cut down on the amount of food they put on people's plates. Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnell-Ogue says behavioural change is needed to reduce food waste. He told The Examiner that customers should be encouraged to go back up for seconds rather than restaurants overloading their plates in the first instance. He also wants, or it could also, of course, lead to the end of the doggy bag, something the minister says no food outlet should be in a position to offer. And we're going to be speaking about struggling restaurants in a moment. Perhaps the big solution is that they're overgenerous. Could but that be the problem, Cathy? Do you agree with the minister?
No, Greg, my experience of eating out, and I don't eat out, you know, a lot, but when I do, I don't find that my plate is already full. I think that there's been a trend towards, you know, putting on customers' plates just what they eat. You know, I certainly the restaurants, you know, my local restaurants, I feel full, but I don't think that there's a lot left over on the plate. I mean, I know when you go to countries like the States, I mean, and they pile them high, and you wonder how could anybody have a healthy waistline or people with the amount of food and sheer food waste that you get. I don't know that this country and our, I don't know that restaurants are a problem. I think that there's maybe a problem with food waste in general in terms of how we all shop, and we could all do a lot more in terms of if we sat down at the start of the week and really meal planned. I know that in my own house, that if I look at the week and plan things out, the food waste tends to be a lot less. That if you're really, you know, organized, then you can make sure, because there's nothing worse, I feel, than going to the fridge and throwing perfectly, well, it was good, but it might be past its sell-by date. And at Christmas time, there's loads of food waste. I think there's an onus on all of us, not just the restaurants, to really get to grips with this, plan a wee bit more and make sure that we don't throw, because I just feel like, you know, it's a sin to throw really, really good food out. But, you know, we all do, especially at Christmas, we're overloaded with stuff that goes off. But maybe it's not just the restaurants. I think that this is a consumer. There's an onus on all of us to really try and tackle this a wee bit, you know?
Yeah, but he focused particularly on the restaurants. And there is some statistics that claim 23% of food waste comes from restaurants. I'm not sure it's being scraped off plates, though, because I'm not a huge eater, but I don't recall leaving any food behind me. And I certainly have never asked for a doggy bag. I actually didn't really even think that was a thing in this country. But that's probably my naivety rather than the reality. I'll come back to you. Mary Hart, do you agree with the minister? Is this something that you've spotted out and about?
No, but I do think, and I agree with Cathy, you know, my experience is not that there's a lot of food piled onto a plate when you go out to eat. And restaurants, I'm sure, have a profit margin, so they're careful about how much they actually do put on a plate for that reason. But, I mean, I know a couple of years ago they did flag up that takeaways, a portion for one person was enough for 2 to 3 people. And I can see where that would be coming from. But I have no great experience of restaurants, and I somehow feel that maybe the cheaper the restaurant that you go to, the bigger the amounts on the plates. And I have no reason to say that, other than that's what my experience may have been. That's, you know, truck drivers, and they like a big feed, and then anybody else that happens to come into that same place will get a big pile of spuds and a whole plate full of fish and chips. But generally, I don't see where this food waste is coming from, as Cathy just said, you know, how that can be ascertained by the minister, or why it has to be flagged up to the extent that it is. Certainly, we do waste a lot of food in this country. Yeah. That's
because I would have thought, to be honest with you, Mary, that sort of restaurants are on a tipping point here, whereby the prices are at a point now whereby you're kind of going, well, we can't really do that. You know, your main courses are in the high teens. If you're having a steak, it's well up into the 20s. And for a lot of people, that's just the point now where they can't do it any longer. And I think if they started putting little amounts of food on the plate, you could write them off altogether. Do you know what I mean? Which was what kind of interested me about these comments. I've never heard anyone complain that there's too much food on the plate. And I don't know. Or left that much behind. John McAteer, what do you think?
I have mixed views about that. There's definitely more food on plates 10 years ago. Restaurants seem to be competing with each other, especially at weddings. The bigger the feed that was put on the plate, the more likely you are to get more business. I think that's long since gone. I've not been in any restaurant of late that has too much food on the plate. Some are slightly different to others. I know that the food business is... issues around margins here all the time. There's always going to be issues around waste. It's very hard to avoid that, because you might ask 250 to a wedding and 50 of them wouldn't turn up. You can't legislate for that. But no, I'm not too sure where that one came out of, because I don't experience too much food on plates. It can be the opposite in certain cases, you know.
That would be more likely my experience, to be honest. But yeah. Anyway, obviously, Minister Charlie McConnell seen something there worth talking about. But yesterday we heard from Donegal chef Gary O'Hanlon that the hospitality industry is struggling, and we may see a number of smaller businesses close. He was looking to buy a business recently, or was certainly interested in it. It was performing well sales-wise, seats were busy and all that type of stuff. But he said the cost of energy in particular and food was such that it was losing money, and he couldn't see a way to go in there and make changes, because these are built-in costs to actually make things better. Mary Hart, do businesses need more support? Because I think hospitality is incredibly important to our economy and the ripple effect it might have in the tourism industry as well. I mean, if someone like Gary O'Hanlon thinks he can't go into a busy restaurant and make money out of it and predicts that restaurants are going to be closing left, right and centre, I think we need to take notice.
Yeah, I mean, I do know that one of the issues flagged up is the high energy costs, and they are scandalously high in this country, and the profit margins of electricity supply companies. We had extra companies coming in to supply energy other than the ESB in order to bring the costs down, we thought, we were told, but that never happened. And I mean, horrendously, you know, millions and millions of profits each year going up and up all the time, which is wrong. You know, certainly the trend at the moment, I find among friends of mine, fewer people are actually eating out after COVID. People tend to be cooking at home, tend to be, you know, and it's, you know, you head out, a taxi, I'm told now, from Letterkenny to Churchill can cost you up to, you know, 25 to 30 euros. And I think from Letterkenny to Rafoe, it's nearly 50. So, you know, if you want to go out and have a glass of wine, then, you know, you won't do it. You'll stay at home and you'll cook at home. And people have become more adept and better skilled and you know, and try the multitude of television programmes of cooking shows you that there is a huge interest in people and how to cook and watching chefs do it properly. So I, you know, there's a whole lot of issues here as to why restaurants are not working. But I think a big factor is that fewer people are actually eating out. And I know that, you know, like in Rafoe, we're going to lose one of our very, very long established eateries in Rafoe and, you know, Freel's Hotel, which was hugely popular and, you know, a wonderful place for everybody to go to. That's all, you know, and that's some place that, you know, they can no longer sustain the profit margin to keep the place running. So a lot of places definitely are struggling, same as pubs. You know, pubs are closing as well. And it's because people are not actually spending money in them and they're just not going there anymore. Trends are changing. That's what I find.
Yeah. John, what do you think? Because I think sometimes as us as the public, you know, when we try and make our finances work, we're kind of suckers to some extent because petrol and diesel prices and home heating oil prices go through the roof and, you know, electricity prices go through the roof and food prices do. And then that sort of settles as a new norm because we try and adjust to it as much as we can. And then, you know, we sort of start seeing prices come down marginally and we're, you know, we think, okay, well, that's fine. But I think we've been hoodwinked to some extent. In a business, it can't be like that because it's quite simple, you know, to be able to provide your services and to make money. You look at things a little bit more intricately. Gary O'Hanlon said, though, that the industry is not complaining enough. What say you, John?
Well, Gary is virtually carrying a can there on his own on national radio. I know Gary, you know him pretty well, and he doesn't pull his punches, but he also knows he's a very experienced businessman, not only a restaurateur, but he's worked in France, he's worked in England, he's worked here. He knows what he's talking about, and it's not possible for him to make a living on a restaurant in Dublin. The cost of three-phase electricity is the real killer. And when you look at the VAT receipts, the government is just rolling it in year after year and month after month, and they're staying very quiet about it. There seems to be no big pressure on the main electricity companies to pull down their prices. They're far, far too high. Price of oil is far too high as well. But in the restaurant business, you're talking about oil, you're talking about gas and electricity, the two most expensive components that have been so hard hit for now, almost 2 years now, price have come back only marginally. They're only at back by about half of where they should be of this time 2 years ago. And that's the real problem, because if the Gary O'Hanlons of this world are going to make a living at this, they're going to have to double their prices. Don't survive that way, because it'll be exorbitant to go out for a meal. It's expensive enough in Dublin anyway, but if you're going to hammer up your prices to try and increase whatever minimal profit margin you have, it's going to close you anyway. So you don't have any options. You have just to depend on the government exerting a lot more pressure on the big energy companies, as Mary says there. They're just raking it in hand over fist, billions upon billions, and there's no end to it. And, you know, here in Donegal, we probably, as Mary's talking about, Freel's Hotel in Rafoe, many of the time I ate there, you're going to see a lot more of that, unfortunately, because people are just not eating out. Maybe they can't afford it. Maybe COVID has had a systemic impact on people's behaviour and people's lives, and there's no end to that.
I think really one of the issues here too, though, Mary, is in terms of the difference between a business opening and closing. There will be waves of when we go out more than when we sort of don't go out more all year round. But like a business will generally have a really good December, and that'll get them through to St. Patrick's weekend, for an example, and then that will get them through to the summer, and then they have the tourism industry and Easter's in there as well. I think what's happening now, though, is the busy months, because of the rising costs that they're having to absorb, the busy months are no longer able to sort of sustain the business during the quieter times when people generally don't go out as much, Mary. And maybe that's why we're seeing the businesses close, even when they appear to be busy at times.
Well, I think there's a combination, as I've said, of various costs hitting. There never was huge profits in the hospitality industry in terms of the food that restaurants supply. I think the generating income was really coming from the wine that's been sold around the table. But that said, I mean, I've never ran a restaurant, but I've worked in many. Worked in the States. I've worked in Dublin, and certainly, you know, there was a more intrigue about going out to eat. You know, you were getting something that you couldn't cook at home or you couldn't find in the supermarket. That has all dramatically changed. Like in America, you don't have people cooking as much at home. They eat out. In Ireland, I think we are cooking more at home, and that may be hitting the restaurants, aside from on top of all of the costs of energy costs. And I, you know, I've just heard, you know, anecdotal the last week, you know, of one of my friends said that she went to get a burger, and it was, when she had the burger, it was €17 for the burger. And, you know,
I've like seen that myself,
in a restaurant.
Yeah.
So, you know, that can't be right. You know, people are not going to pay. People are deciding when it comes to that.
And just generally in terms of controlling the electricity prices, Mary, we see some of the highest rates in Europe. We have this painful situation where consistently a third of our electricity is generated through wind and what have you, but it doesn't really seem to benefit us because of the way the payment for that is structured, okay? Should the government be doing more to say, right, lads, you know, you need to stop gouging here? That's not an unreasonable expectation, Mary, is it? No?
No, I mean, it's not an unreasonable expectation. I mean, the ESB had it all their own way for many, many years, and they were, you know, semi-state or state-owned. And then the commercial companies, so it was deregulated to that point. The ESB still control all of it. They still own everything. And then the various Network Ireland and all of the rest of them all, you know, hive off the ESB and make their profits. I do believe that the government should step in and try and negotiate lower energy costs. We have, I mean, this year, I think it was last week, it was announced that we, or even this week, that 1.2 billion surplus in our exchequer. But going back to, you know, we have a problem in Ireland. We have to import most of our energy, and that is also a big factor. You know, we have to, you know, it's fossil fuels. Wind power is never, ever going to provide the energy for the country. That's just not going to happen. And, you know, I don't know where you go. Do you go into the very safe, small type of nuclear energy power stations? And there's just a bad taste in Ireland for that. Every other country uses it, and we buy it from France, you know, so we're okay buying it from somebody, but we're not okay having it on our own island. Sea wave power, I think, is that would be my preference. I hate wind turbines. I absolutely hate them. They're a blight on the landscape.
Really?
Absolutely.
Like, I can understand
that. Masquerade as nice things, but they're not nice things. It takes as much money to make one of those.
Yeah.
They only last about 20 years, and then they have to be replaced. And they are made out of metal and
the concrete poured into the bogs. Don't forget
everything.
That.
They destroy the landscape. And they don't provide. They're never capable of providing any more than 20% of power.
Yeah, well, if we figured out how to store power, it might be somewhat different. Okay, we'll have more from Kathy, Mary and John after this short break. Some of the comments coming in. We used to eat out in some lovely restaurants once a week as we don't enjoy the pub scene any longer. Yes, restaurants have become expensive. So these days, instead of dining out 4 to 5 times a month, we now go out 1 to 2 times as we've seen quite an increase in prices. How dare the minister say there should be no doggy bags? If I'm paying for my food and don't eat it all, I'm surely entitled to take it home with me. If they're going to say about the risk of food poisoning, can we get the records from hospitals? There was no reference to food poisoning. It shows you how far removed Minister McConnell is if he thinks people in Donegal can afford to eat out. Another, I've noticed that there's a lot less on plates now. Any less with prices, they may close. So extra staff time to stop wasted food would not waste money and increase costs. Better to have 3 portion sizes, say small, medium, large, with 3 cost levels. Another, very few restaurants are filling the plates. They reduced plate sizes years ago. There are many reasons people might want to take home food. Some restaurants won't give out doggy bags as the food will be reheated and there's a high risk of food poisoning. You have to sign a document to say that the restaurant is not liable for any food poisoning you may get after leaving the premises. Again, this is a world completely new to me. You never leave food if it's tasty. If there's food left on plates, it must not have been very tasty. And food left on plates, I think they're totally wrong. I ate in a restaurant in Boncrana before Christmas and I felt that there wasn't enough food. We're paying enough and we're not getting much. I would disagree that portions should be smaller. Two more. We had a meal in a hotel. The plates were definitely not overloaded. There was nothing on the plates. Maybe they'd already been told about the doggy bag situation. And another, there's a bigger issue than food waste. People can't afford to put food on a plate. People can't afford food, never mind waste it. There's a food hunger in the country. And I think in fairness, John, to a politician commenting on an issue, right, if you're talking about new statistics that come out in food waste, and then you sort of talk about a 23% food waste in this area, it doesn't mean that you don't realise that there are those that never eat out and would struggle to put food on your table. You can't put caveats on every comment either, in fairness to the minister.
There's 4 of us on the programme this morning and none of us are really acutely aware of too much food on plates. And, you know, it should be that should represent a fairly decent cross-section. And those comments coming in there add to that, you know.
Yeah.
I can't say that I'm aware of it. I don't know too much about takeaways because I would rarely ever use them. But I know that there's pretty generous portions. And 2 people can eat a takeaway and it'll do for the dinner.
Why bother cooking? I split my Chinese 2 days over 2 days way I would do it. And I am so good with my money and break. I've eaten for €7 a day or €6 a day. It's great. Okay. It's in your gift, Kathy, and if you believed in your gift and it were achievable, what change might you make? Or what measure would you introduce to improve 2024 for the population or what have you? You know, we're heading into a new year and for some it's like, oh, another year. Like, I never celebrate the new year too much because my mortgage comes out on the 2nd of January and it's a wake-up call that this year is going to be very much like the last year. But, Kathy, is there anything that you'd like to see change nationally that would sort of improve life, you know, for individuals or society?
I was thinking about, you know, the new year, Greg, and I'm a bit like you. I don't tend to go for resolutions or make grand plans in January because I just think, you know, we've all this stuff coming at us, you know, new year, new you, better you, you know, here's sort out your finances, sort out your health, sort out everything, you know, and it can feel like I just want to pull the duvet over my head and say, you know, I'm going to wait till spring. This is dark and cold and it's a very difficult time, I think, for people to think about making changes in their lives, you know, because we're not really feeling it. I thought, you know, I mean, this, I think we've come out of 2023 was a really, really difficult year in terms of the global stage, the images that we were seeing, you know, in our homes every night of, you know, Palestinian children dying in the street and their homes being dropped on their heads. And, you know, we've seen the war in Ukraine is still going on. We, you know, we're seeing climate change, you know, and I think that does, you know, we all live in this world. So I suppose when I think about what I'd like to see happen, I try and think of not just, you know, what's happening in Donegal, what's happening on, because actually geography dictates where we live and it's just geography. This could be any of us. And I suppose if someone says, you know, as long as not one of us is free, as long as, you know, one of us is enslaved or this is happening to someone somewhere else or someone else's children, it's you know, we can't turn a blind eye to this. And I thought, I was writing about this before Christmas because I felt totally overwhelmed as a human being, as a mother, to see these things happening, you know. And I was talking to a professor of psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, Brendan Kelly, and he made the point that, you know, how we feel in ourselves, you know, affects, it has this ripple effect of what's going on around us. And I think, you know, we're not islands. So my big thing this year is to try and be the best I can be and be the ripple effect and be the change that I want to see in the world.
But it's funny you should say that, Kathy, because, you know, I agree with you, but I think sometimes we as individuals, our only survival mechanism is sometimes to shut out the outside world, that you couldn't allow yourself to think of the awful experience of particularly the children of Gaza or what's happening in Ukraine or what may happen in between China and Taiwan, for an example. And then I think we don't affect change because we're actually just going to our own personal mental health survival mode. Now, I'm not saying that detracts from you know, you trying to sort of the policy you're adopting, but that's what happens is I think anyway, and the people around me, you just try and insulate yourself from it because it's so overwhelming, and there it just runs on.
Exactly, but I think, Greg, there, you know, we can go into fight or flight mode, and that is true. But in every situation, we've got to put our own oxygen mask on first, and do what we can in our own. We cannot live in it where we just look at these images and are paralysed with fear and doubt, and you know, where we do nothing. But from a place of safety, you know, there are things that we can do, and this is the same when it comes to climate change, when it comes to, you know, things happening on our own county. You know, I do think as well, we've got to come back to a point of, in our discourse, in our lives, we've got to come back to a place of civility and listening, right? Public discourse has become so coarse. Everybody has the blinkers on. It's my way or the highway. You know, we have got to start listening, and there has to be a plurality of views expressed, and we take those on board, because right now what we're seeing is everybody shuts everything down. This is my place. I sit on my own.
I think that's the protection for half of the people that don't want to think about climate change or whatever. And it might be half, or it might be less. The way is just to say that Kathy's talking nonsense. It's all part of a global agenda, and that's and they sit very firmly in that view and get their comfort from that view, I think.
Yeah. I don't know that there's a comfort in that view, Greg. I think there's a fear. I think there's a fear in that view. I think fear is allowing that view to be fostered. I think if we all start listening to one another with empathy and kindness, right? Instead of just, you know, lashing in with the view that comes off the top of the head, then we can actually start to say, well, maybe there is something in this, right? So I suppose I would love to see a less of a coarsening of the public discourse, where people were actually listening with empathy to one another, to other views that are outside of their own. From that place, I believe we can begin to take other views on board. We can challenge narratives. We can see, well, maybe I'm wrong about this, you know? And then from that place, it can inform so much change around us. And from, you know, we have to start small, because the problems of the world right now, if we were to think about it at a global level, we would just go back to bed.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got to start small. And that comes down to, and I suppose, you know, in this county, I would love to see this be the year, finally, that we get this MICA situation, you know, finished, that people have homes that are fit for purpose that they can go into. Because, you know, I live in Inishowen, in a community where, and I spoke to Anthony Dugan, the principal of our local school, this is affecting such vast numbers of school populations. I'm sure it's the same in Carndonagh Community School and other community schools around the country. You know, we saw in this county legacy issues when Fruit of the Loom, you know, collapsed. You know, what we don't want is a legacy issue where young people in this county, you know, parents don't have a choice to make, where, you know, we can't send you to college because, you know, we've got all these bills mounting up. We do not want that leg. So I would love that the awful legacy of MICA would come to an end finally, and that people could live their lives and get on with their lives.
Okay.
You know, that would be a big, because that would lift all boats in this county. This is, and that's on all of us. And I really feel very strongly about that this year, that this gets done.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's clear from your tone. Mary Hart, what would you like to see for 24?
I think the last time you asked me this question at the start of the new year, Greg, I said if I could, I would have all of the satellites zooming over the Earth decommissioned so that we are back to a level playing field and where we get our news and our information from well-trained, experienced news outputs, and that those that are unregulated peddling disinformation and conspiracy theories on a social media platform that's totally and absolutely gone, like a horrible monster around the planet. So that would be my dear wish if I could do that, but I can't. So therefore, what I would like to see happen in this country at the moment, and I'm unlike Kathy, I'm bringing it right back into Ireland as such, that I would like to see the government step in to be more proactive to stop the hate of the racial hatred that has suddenly landed at nearly every one of our doorsteps. In my town, it is starting to come through on a social media platform. Whatever happened to, you know, Ireland of the welcomes? And let's not forget, and I'm not being Republican in a big way in this, but, you know, this country was the victim of colonial power for hundreds of years. And, you know, less than 150 years ago, we had people evicted from their homes, fleeing famine, trying to find a living in another country, landing in their hundreds at, you know, Ellis Port in America or Ellis Island. And we should remember that. And we should be welcoming everybody that we can into this country. Now, I know there are issues with accommodation, but the accommodation can be resolved. This is all to do with the government not building enough houses and homes for social housing in this country. And that's a different argument altogether. But to find people within our community saying they don't want anybody coming into their community. So how is it their community? Their community doesn't exist unless everybody is in it. And, you know, I'm not in it. I'm not against any family, lovely families coming into the area. Mm-hmm. They're happy to work. They're well educated.
In fairness, though, so Mary, and we can't get in. Well, we can. Or we can't. It's up to you. For the most part, what I see, it isn't families. It's large groups of young men coming into areas that seem to be triggering an awful lot of the conversation online and in person that you talk of. As I say, there's no go back and forward on that.
Yeah, but do we not have bad men in this country? Do we not have bad men in the courts every single day of the week in Letterkenny that are Irish, that are from Letterkenny, that are beating people up on the streets, that are robbing, that are, you know, there are people, and I know people who are on these sites who are in the courts, who are bad and who are Irish.
And so it is quite interesting, you know, when you see...
A man is foreign, he is not bad.
When you see another gangland war just about to erupt, you don't see anyone standing with their mobile phone and a microphone in those areas saying, you know, we need to get these people out because it would simply be too dangerous. You go to, you know what I mean? That's I find that quite interesting that no one wants to talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
We went to Dublin, you have the Kinahan gang, you have the, you know, the Gilligan, you know, you have people butchering. And these are Irish people butchering 17-year-olds and putting them in different parts of bins, you know, so... Yeah, I don't get it.
Yep, and that's your view, and listeners would know their view, and often I would put the other side to it, but that's your view. I asked you a question, and we're not going to sort of back and forward on that. Not that I disagree with you, by the way, Mary, but in terms of teasing out issues, you know what I'm saying. John, what about you? Maybe you want to comment on what either Kathy or Mary said or what you would hope for 2024. I'd say you'd look for a general election in 2024, would you?
I think we might be getting one, but... No, I'd be focusing to a great extent on doing something very proactively about the situation at A&E units right across this country. And when you look at the death of that young Johnson girl down in Limerick Regional Hospital, and you go back to Savita Halepanavar all of those years ago, nothing has changed. And that's an absolute disgrace because there'll be some sort of an inquiry into that. And we'll move on and there'll be new regulations and all that put in place. But 6 months down the road, the situation is so bad that you can't implement regulations when you have two nurses looking after 97, 98 very ill people, and you have to try and prioritise who can we see tonight or who must wait till tomorrow. They may well be dead. We're in an awful situation from that point of view. Like from a third world point of view, the whole infrastructure of the country is in a complete mess because of lack of investment. But health and A&E and waiting times. Mm. Horror stories coming in from A&E, you know, right around the country of very elderly people left on hard chairs, slumped down on their chest, fast asleep, and maybe a needle stuck in a vein, and all this kind of thing. That is something that has been completely out of control. It's a long, long time since Mary Harron in 2006 promised that, give me 3 years and we'll resolve the health crisis.
I think, though, the tone of the conversation is going to be different this year, because I think Stephen Donnelly is going to take on the hospitals. He's saying, look, we're providing beds, we're providing staff. The reason there's so many people on trolleys is because you're not discharging people 7 days a week, you're doing 5 days a week. The reason there's only two staff on to deal with so many patients is because you're not rostering them correctly. I think he's rolling his sleeves up, and I think he's going to take on, and he did to some extent take on the management of the hospital when he was up here in a recent visit. I think that's going to be the government's tone this year, that they're saying, look, we're pumping money into the health service, but it's being run badly.
The minister coming up here is always going to be a political exercise. It's going to be a PR exercise to the point of that we're doing this, we're doing that, we're doing the other thing. But from the point of view of patients waiting at the hospital, it hasn't improved very much. I know that the waiting time for ambulance has improved from talking to people at that end of the system. But the whole infrastructure of beds and wards, I mean, remember that 35 years ago, there was 3,500 beds taken out of the whole system. Limerick Regional Hospital was created out of that. Galway Regional Hospital is much the same. It's covering a smaller area. These are the issues that we all need to focus on. Maybe it's time that when we're writing editorials, we should be naming ministers and calling them out every week of the year.
I wouldn't do that.
But housing, why not?
Doesn't work well for you, does it?
I would see. But housing is a perennial problem, no matter what we seem to do about it, because the government seems to have yielded control of housing to the multi-million pound developers, and they will build for profit. It's a commodity. It's not a house. It's as much as they can get for a house. When you see the Sunday Business Post advertising, the Sunday Business Post is read by a cohort of people in Dublin, they're selling houses for €835,000 for three bedrooms. A four-bedroom house, €1.2 million, all this kind of thing. And we claim we're making progress, and yet we have the ESRI and another agency about to come out with data that's going to suggest that we need to be building between an extra 50 to 62,000 houses per year. And here's the government clapping their hands that we built 29,000. I mean, where in the hell are they going with that? Idle nonsense.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll have to take a quick break. Darren on Facebook says, does Mary not remember what happened in Sligo by a man from the Religion of Peace who would have kept on killing if not caught? You hate your own people, she says, but listen, like, what happened on Christmas Eve, you know, in Dublin. Look, I don't want to mention, it's hard to mention cases here in Donegal, but we've had amazing young people slaughtered in their kitchens in this county recently. Do you know what I mean? Horrific, horrific stories. I get where Darren's coming from, but you can't sort of pick out a case in Sligo in isolation. If we're going to have a debate and a discussion and an argument, it has to be in a real space to say that, look, the majority of violent crime in this country continues to be, carried out by Irish people. That's not an attack on the Irish people, but if we're going to have debates, we do have to have them really out in the open with all the facts on the table, I think, Mary.
Yeah, I mean, there is, of course, there's always going to be somebody from another country. If we have a country where we have people living in that, there's always going to be, they're not all holy angels. But what I am saying is that there seems to be this belief that if you're coming in as a refugee, that you're bad and not good. But let's not get away from the fact that we have a lot of bad people that were born in this country peddling, you know, guns and knives and shooting and killing each other. We don't have to go looking for foreign people to blame.
A counterpoint to that that I often read, yes, indeed, that is a problem. So why would you make that problem worse by bringing more potential criminals into the country? And I'm only saying that because that's what you see online. That's what someone might post under you if you stuck that on social media.
And why is somebody coming into this country a criminal? How come they're a criminal?
They're not really criminals, Mary.
Well, they're not criminals. I'm saying that they're not criminals.
There's a section of society on the far right getting away with criminalizing people. For their own purposes. And we need to stop that. The government needs to be much more proactive and in also, following
but
up.
But I think everyone needs to do a bit of fact-checking because there was a post put up before Christmas. And to say, I try and keep the conversation as balanced as possible, but talked about how there was this... There was something like, 12% of the prison population is foreigners. That'll tell you everything you need to know. I think it's something like 16, 17% of the population are foreigners. So actually the foreigners' representation in the Irish prison system is actually below the population. But no one challenged that. I was going to challenge it. I thought, why would I bring that on myself in the run-up to Christmas? You know what I mean? Because I would have just been absolutely annihilated online if I'd have pointed out this obvious fact. But I think, Cathy, people need to, regardless of your point of view, is check things and fact-check. Because it seems if something aligns to your point of view, you will just accept it to be truthful. I think we all have a responsibility to check what we're being told, no?
Yeah, no, and I agree with you, Greg. And it's a big bugbear of mine. And I agree with Mary when she says, so many people think that they're journalists now and they post what they think are facts. Now, I've been trained for nearly 30 years to actually know what a fact is and to actually go and find truth and put that out there, disseminate information, find the truth, find both sides, find the balance. That's what journalists do. But unfortunately, our profession has been so downgraded by absolute far-right nonsense on social media, everybody dresses themselves up as, oh, it's my truth, my truth, my truth. No, there's a truth. There's a kernel of truth in something.
But the establishment...
It's not an individual.
But the problem is it's a race to the bottom because the establishment will try and shut down questions. The establishment will try and shut down critical thinking or challenging points of view. Do you know what I mean? It's not just one side. It almost is like a race to the bottom. You do see it now that I don't like your questions. That's that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I think it's
across the board. I would not be a fan, and it's up to you what you think and you think, Cathy, but sort of suggest that's only one section of society that does that. I think it's starting to happen across the board now.
Perhaps.
But something? The actual fact is here that the law of libel is applicable to anybody that puts something on social media. If I write a story tomorrow on the front of the Tribune, it's subject to libel, it's subject to legal investigation, which sometimes happens. But the same applies to somebody sitting in a back room peddling rubbish on social media and telling lies. But it's not been followed up. I can't understand why the government is not dealing with that. We can talk till the cows come home about social media, but it's not regulated. Governments and probably the EU as a body haven't come to terms with the huge spread of falsehood and lies, and where fiction is put out as fact.
I think there's zero interest in following up on that, John, by some of the social media companies. I mean, they've shut down a lot of their investigation units. They've shut down. They've pared it back so that people can say things. And I agree with you, Greg. Somebody puts up something, absolutely disgusting on social media. Are you going to jump in and say,
no, you're not going to take it on?
You're not, because these trolls are so toxic. I have a policy where it is block.
I think we're at a stage where the government needs to look at having a particular ministry or a junior minister to look specifically only at social media.
All right,
media
I want to come back on a point on that because it has to be on the flip side as well, all right? Because, at the end of the day, if we're going to fact check on one side, we have to fact check on the other side in terms of, often we do see on government ministers or representatives or opposition elected representatives saying stuff, right, that's clearly disprovable. Who's fact checking them about putting that information out?
But that's
for journalists. That's where journalists come in.
But Mary, see, that's the problem. You see, you try and do that, and then you shut down for doing so as well. You see, that was the wider point that I was trying to make. You know, it has to be acceptable.
Why would you be shut down? Because, I mean, I've worked as a journalist for 40 plus years, and, you know, we could never, ever say anything unless you had both sides of the story checked, and some would not broadcast anything or write anything unless it was actually fact-checked and balanced.
Right, so say, for instance, for an example, okay, say, for instance, there's a multi-billion euro scheme for this county that's announced by the government, and neither Dara O'Brien or Minister Charlie McConlogue will speak to the local media about it, okay? Any of the local media about it, and they say it's 100% and it will satisfy everybody's needs, right? How, if they will not speak to the media to welcome this multi-billion euro scheme, how could a journalist hold them to account?
Oh, like, there's an easy way of dealing with that, Greg. Just don't believe any of them until it actually happens. And most of the stuff that's coming out from government sources is a bit of PR spin, massaging figures, massaging egos. You can't talk directly. You can't lift a phone now and ring a government office. You can't even talk to an official in Donegal County Council. You have to go through their press section. And all of this is diminishing the role of journalism. It's diminishing the role of getting facts out into the public domain.
John, and that's when we start talking about the government cracking down on misinformation on social media, that any right-thinking member of the public goes, seriously? You want to take away our right to have an opinion? You want to take our right away to express what we feel on social media? But the government can insulate themselves and peddle, peddle whatever they want to peddle, avoid confrontation or questioning. Do you get where I'm coming from? Therein lies, I think, a broader problem in this country, and it's not just here.
The government has a press office. I prefer to call them a spin machine because that's all they ever do. They employ the best journalists in the country and they pay them the best money to hold on to them. The media has lost some of the best journalists. I think it was Leo Varadkar was in 2017 set up this famous spin machine in the government. And now Fine Gael is thinking of setting up a policy department to generate policy. And you just wonder where they're going with this.
Okay, we have a final minute or two with John McAteer, Cathy Donaghy and Mary Hart. Mary, I think you wanted to come in there just before the break, and I don't want to stymie what you were going to say.
No, just to go back on what John said, you know, about disinformation and not getting the truth. And I remember when I did work as an information officer many years ago with the Department of Justice, and the head of the Department of Justice at that time said anything that's said by any government minister or any politician in the run-up to an election should be declared null and void after the election is over. So basically, you know, we all know that what you're hearing is not really going to be the full truth. I do think there is, I mean, when I was working there, you know, there was always a criticism by the media, because I was on the other side at that stage, you know, of governments having their own information officers, and it should have been all in the government information office. And that has now gone beyond, like, it's massive now. Media in government is massive. And the fourth estate and the journalists are like the small fry now trying to get the information out. And it is really, really difficult. And I do agree with you, Greg. You know, there is, that's what they do. You know, their job is to tell the story and tidy it up and make it nice and appeal to the public. But, you know, the journalists do their best to try and break down what is it actually you are really telling us. And it's very difficult.
But unfortunately, you see, too, then the access that becomes part of it. So you know, the likes of the RT, which I have no issue with, they get a minister a morning, you know, and it's clear sometimes what topics are on the table and what topics are not. But anyway, listen, it is what it is, and we'll battle on through. But I think we need more openness and transparency right across, left, right, middle, elected, non-elected, social media. Cathy Donaghy, journalist and author of Finding My Wild, time has caught up on us. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you on the programme and to have your insights. Really appreciated. Mary Hart, journalist and broadcaster, have a wonderful day and thank you for your time. And it's wonderful to have you on Decent Broadband.
I don't know why that happens. It's just by fluke.
No, but it's great. It's such a pleasure. It's such a pleasure, genuinely. So it's been fantastic to be able to hear you and see you so clearly. Thanks so much, Mary. And last but certainly not least, John McAteer, working on Wednesday evening, Thursday's Tyrconnell Tribune already, I guess.
Yes, indeed, Greg, and thanks for having me.
No, it's our pleasure, John, always. We'll be chatting to you plenty throughout the course of this year. Take care of yourself, John. Bye-bye. And listen, thank you so much for all the comments that are coming in. We will get to them as we move on. Don't forget, Seamus Gunn's going to be answering your legal questions after we take the news and obituary notices. So stay tuned for that as well. And it's not too late to get a question in, 086 60 25000, and we'll endeavour to get that answered for you. Or you can give us a call on 074 91 25000. OK, we'll be back, as I say, after the news and the obituary notices.